I'm here with Dr. Akiva Lieberman, who's written a research and brief for NIJ on adolescence, neighborhoods, and violence. Welcome, Akiva.
Thank you, Jolene.
This is a two-part podcast, and today we're talking about two studies out of the Project on Human Development in Chicago neighborhoods, one study on race and violence, and the other study on exposure to firearms violence. Right. Akiva, tell us a little bit about the RIB first.
This research and brief summarizes the findings from four published articles coming out of the Project on Human Development in Chicago neighborhoods. Today we're going to talk about two of them. One of them concerns race, ethnicity, and violence, and the other concerns the effects of exposure to gun violence. I should say that I didn't conduct any of this research myself. I'm summarizing it. The paper on race, ethnicity, and violence was written by Robert Sampson, Jeff Morinoff, and Steve Rowdenbush. And the paper on the effects of exposure to gun violence was written by Jeff Bingenheimer, Robert Brennan, and Felton Earls. I've just summarized them for our audience.
Okay, the ethnicity and the race article that you summarized in this research and brief. Tell us about that one.
Okay, that article was published in 2005 in the American Journal of Public Health. And it attempted to answer the question, why do adolescents of different racial and ethnic groups seem to commit violence at different rates?
Seem to or do?
Well, they actually do. The result of the study is that these participants who are asked about how much violence they themselves have committed differ in their reports as a function of race and ethnicity. The black kids report committing more violence. The Mexican American kids report committing the least violence, a bit less than the whites, and everybody else is somewhere in the middle. And so that's a long-standing kind of finding, although sometimes it comes out of arrest reports, but here it's from self-reported violence. And they sought to see whether they could explain why that would be.
And what did they find? Could they explain the differences?
They found that they were able to explain about 60% of the black-white gap and all of the Mexican-American-white gap by three basic factors. Those being whether the kids' parents are married, their immigrant generation, and features of their neighborhoods.
And what was there one that was the largest influence?
Of those three, the neighborhoods had the largest influence, and that explained about a third of the black-white gap.
Okay, so are we talking about collective efficacy in the neighborhood then? Is that what they found?
Actually, they didn't. In this study, again, this is from the longitudinal study, they found that the presence of lots of first-generation immigrants in the neighborhood and the presence of professionals living in the neighborhood are both protective factors. And neighborhood residents who are cynical about the law is a risk factor for those adolescents committing violence.
Did I hear you correctly that being an immigrant is a protective factor? How does that work?
Well, first of all, it's worth pointing out that findings about immigration were consistent at both the individual level and at the neighborhood level. So individual kids who are first-generation immigrants commit less violence than second generation, who commit less violence than third generation. That's at the individual level. At the neighborhood level, kids living in neighborhoods with lots of first generation immigrants commit less violence too. Now, it's important to just give this a little context. We're talking mostly about immigration from Latin America, primarily Mexico, in Chicago, at the period being studied here. And contrary to some stereotypes, perhaps, yes, the first-generation immigrants have much better outcomes on a whole variety of things, also some health outcomes, compared to whites of comparable means.
But I thought immigrants tend to be poorer and more disadvantaged than whites. So how does the poor poverty and disadvantage...
Well, we try to distinguish these things by comparing implicitly in statistical models, by comparing immigrants and non-immigrants at similar levels of poverty, so that these are, we can disentangle those. And it turns out that immigrants do much better for the level of wealth or poverty that they have compared to whites, and also compared to later generation immigrants.
Compared to later generations of immigrants. I think I've heard you talk a little bit about this acculturation effect. Can you explain to us the...
Yeah, there's two different hypotheses that haven't really been completely settled, I think, but both might have an element of truth to them. One is that the first generation immigrants who come over are especially law-abiding, motivated, hardworking. There's also health outcomes. Maybe they also are particularly healthy and hardy and so on, because it's hard to get here.
Mm-hmm.
And then their kids don't inherit that completely, and then their grandkids even less so. So they come with some kind of inborn advantage with regard to the kind of things we're talking about that wears off with with generations. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that there's something negative happening to their kids and grandkids as a function of being here. That's called the acculturation paradox. And that is, we're talking here about immigrants from Latin America, primarily. And they come here and they're striving as best they can to fulfill kind of mainstream American values. They're striving to achieve mainstream American goals. Their kids and grandkids notice some rift between the Latino community and the mainstream white community and become somewhat alienated as a function of that.
Mm.
And over time, they then start identifying with some kind of countercultural tendencies. So these are two possibilities. They both might be true to some degree.
Akiva, can we move now to the exposure to gun violence findings?
Yes, those came out also in 2005 in Science magazine, and the first author is Jeffrey Bingenheimer. And that study explored what are the effects of being exposed to gun violence, either by witnessing it, being a victim yourself, or having a family member who was victimized.
What were the findings?
The findings were that the kids exposed to gun violence were twice as likely to commit violence themselves as kids who were not exposed to gun violence.
But maybe the kids who committed violence had a propensity to being violent anyway. I believe in your rib you mentioned many of those kids were more impulsive and aggressive. Their parents used corporal punishment more. And so how did the researchers tease out the differences between kids who were more likely to be violent from the kids who were exposed to violence?
This is a very important issue you're raising.
Mm-hmm.
It's the issue of trying to reach causal conclusions from non-experimental data.
Mm.
And there's a couple things to say about it. First of all, they took advantage of the longitudinal design to at least know what came first and what came second. So in the second project interview, you'll remember there were three interviews with each kid.
Mm-hmm.
In the second interview, kids were asked about whether or not they had witnessed or been victims of gun violence. At their third project interview, which is about 2.5 years later, they were asked about any violence they'd committed over the last 12 months. So the first thing we know is that it's not a chicken-egg problem. But even so, as you mentioned, there are lots of differences between kids exposed to gun violence and kids who aren't. And the main challenge for this paper was to disentangle that. And the goal is basically to be able to compare kids who are similar on all those things, but some were exposed to gun violence and some aren't. So instead of just comparing the group of all kids who are exposed to gun violence, mm-hmm. simply to all kids who weren't, what you try and do is get groups who are very similar and just do comparisons within those groups. In this case, they used a method called propensity score stratification. They divided the kids up into 12 strata, 12 groups. And the difference between them is how much they were at risk of exposure to gun violence. And that takes into account all those other things that you were talking about. Neighborhood characteristics, their individual psychological background, stuff about their family, peers, all that is taken into account. Mm-hmm. And then kids who are at high risk of exposure to gun violence because of all that stuff are looked at. And those among that group with high risk, those who were actually exposed are compared in outcomes to those who were not exposed. And similarly, kids who are at low risk of exposure to gun violence, but some of them were exposed, are compared to similarly low-risk kids who weren't exposed. In this way, most of that possible bias is eliminated.
So now let's ask the question that all the chiefs of police want to know about how they can make their neighborhoods safer. Based on what the research shows, what are the policy implications?
Well, let's work backwards. Starting with the paper on exposure to gun violence, this paper, I think, is the strongest methodological study to date about what the effects of witnessing gun violence are. You can't do an experiment on this question, and so any results...
You can't do an experiment on this question because...
I can't experimentally decide I'm going to have some kids get shot at,
right,
or witness somebody get shot,
okay,
and see what the effect is. So we are left to resort to what are called observational or correlational studies. And it's very difficult to be confident that you've gotten cause and effect relationships. This study is probably as strong, I would guess, as you're going to get at addressing this. And it finds a pretty dramatic effect of exposure to gun violence. That seems to confirm the pretty common sense notion that there's kind of a cycle of violence. People who witness and are exposed to violence are more likely to themselves commit more, and then, of course, people who witness them committing it are likely to commit more themselves. So this suggests that you want to interrupt that cycle of violence and that it will have long-lasting effects. That's the first kind of policy implication. And particulars about how you control gun violence and how you limit access to guns and so on, I will leave to others to discuss.
How about this question then? How do you make your neighborhoods have more collective efficacy? Because the more collective efficacy in my neighborhood, the safer my neighborhood is.
Right. That's a great question, and that's what everybody asks the researchers, and they always defer the question. And the reason is that they didn't do a study trying to change the level of collective efficacy. They just did a study finding that the level of collective efficacy is related to all kinds of good and bad things that happen. To find out what changes collective efficacy requires a whole new research project, intervention studies, which are difficult to do. And I would say that they've identified the target for the intervention. Now we have to do the hard work to develop interventions that might actually affect collective efficacy.
What about race? What implications are there for what we know about race and violence?
Well, the most obvious implication is that it's not race per se that's creating differences in violence. And that might lead one to be somewhat more optimistic about the future. Let me conclude with Samson, Moronoff, and Rodenbusch's own words. They conclude by writing, "We conclude that the large racial and ethnic disparities in violence found in American cities are not immutable. Indeed, they are largely social in nature and therefore amenable to change."
Okay, that's a good positive note to end on. Thank you very much. Akiva Lieberman, a social science analyst here at the National Institute of Justice.
My pleasure to be here.